Did you know the minimum salary for a Major League Baseball player these days is more than $500,000? Now, most players make a lot more than that sum in the tens of millions of dollars every year. But there was a time when ballplayers earned salaries measured in the tens of thousands of dollars, not the tens of millions. When they played on grass and traveled by train. It was during that era that a young radio sportscaster broke into the business. His name was Kurt Gowdy. And over the coming decades, he became one of America's best-known sports broadcasters. I met him in 1993, the year he wrote a book about what he called the innocent days of sport. But he conceded that the years 1945 to 1960 were probably kinder to the team owners and executives than to the players.
The players couldn't have an agent or a lawyer, couldn't go in and negotiate. Here a kid could be 22, come from a farm, and he'd have to go in and negotiate his own contract with tough general managers like George Weiss. It was unfair. And these young players weren't skilled in that negotiating and business and things. All they wanted to do was play ball. So I can understand how the players used to say they were slaves because they had nowhere to go. And if they didn't, DiMaggio held out in 19, his third year, held out for $40,000. And the Yankees offered him 25, a raise of 10,000. And DiMaggio held out and quickly capitulated when he saw he wasn't going to get any more. He went to New York, and Colonel Rupert, the owner of the brewery, met with him and said, "And you don't get paid until you're in position to play in condition. Just because you're here in New York, your salary doesn't start until Joe McCarthy says you're ready to play in the major leagues." And then he turned to the press and said, "Joe DiMaggio, have you received the bonus to sign this contract?" And DiMaggio sort of gulped and said, "No." He said, "That's right. He has no bonus for signing this contract. This is what we offered him, and this is what he's getting." And Rupert was really tough on him. And they were tough in those days. And they had you, you know.
It sounds so innocent compared to the Barry Bonds of today.
Yeah.
It's $24 million before he sets foot on the field.
Well, this is what's good about this period in a way. We've had so many advances, you know, with television and this and that. David Halberstam, who wrote the season of 49, came up to see me because I had been with the Yankees that season. And then I went with the Red Sox in 51, and I knew everybody. And I told him a lot about the Red Sox players and this and that. He told me, in the jacket of the book on the inside, he quoted me as saying, Kurt Gowdy said this was the innocent days of sports, which it was. And he told me, he said, "You should write a book about this period because you were part of it, and you're lucky you lasted this long, and let the people know how it was in those days." But there was no cocaine. I never heard of cocaine. There was no police blotters that you read now in the sports pages of the athletes, rapes and all these kind of things going on. They always had drinkers on ball clubs. I guess some girl chasers. But for the most part, these guys played because they loved it and wanted to play. And they played on grass. We traveled by train. Everything was different then. And I wanted to bring that period of time in American sports forward.
It really puts it in perspective when you remind us that there were, you said, six teams in the NHL. There was no NBA.
That's right.
That Portland, when it won the first NCAA basketball championship, had to wire for money to get back to Portland from Chicago. It really was a different era that those of us who were not born until the period that you're writing about would understand.
That's right. I remember it. Here's the prologue, the opening sentence. An outfielder for the St. Louis Browns had one arm. St. Mary's College had 22 17-year-olds on his football team, all 4F. Racetracks were closed, auto racing forbidden, boxing titles frozen. World War II changed everything in America, and sports were not immune. How could they be normal when nothing else was? In my opening chapter, the first big football game I ever broadcast, I was hired in Oklahoma City to go down there and broadcast University of Oklahoma football. And the first game I did was at Mikey Stadium when Army played Oklahoma. And on to New York, when my days with the Yankees. And then my days doing the basketball at Madison Square Garden when, unfortunately, the scandals in college basketball. When young men were being dragged in with handcuffs and shielding their face with their handcuffs and being dragged into police stations for fixing games. I sat there in Madison Square Garden, and I knew basketball, and I could broadcast it. I played at the University of Wyoming. I never dreamed that they were fixing those games. And all the coaches, none of them dreamed that. But they were, and it nearly killed college basketball. And Joe Lapchick, the head coach at St. John's, every year used to bring his squad in with his big scrapbook about the scandals and remind them of what could happen to you if something happened like this. Then I went to Boston, the Red Sox, and Tom Yawkey, and Ted Williams. I have the last chapter in the books on Ted Williams, who became a great friend of mine and a very, very engaging guy, the most colorful athlete I've ever known. And then I broadcast the Celtics for a year in 51, and the Red Sox made me quit because the seasons overlapped, you know. But Red Auerbach asked me to do the games. I mean, he knew I was a basketball man. And he said the Celtics were drawing 3,000 or 4,000 a game. It was a hockey town. He said, they don't know basketball up here. And I watched the Celtics start their dynasty. They had Cousy then. When Bill Russell joined them, they had the greatest dynasty in the history of pro sports, 11 titles in 13 years. I always thought dynasties, anybody can have a dynasty. John Wooden, Vince Lombardi, that takes great discipline. Red Auerbach, John Havlicek used to tell me, I'm an all-star pro, and I'm not even going to make the ball club, according to Auerbach. I got to earn my way every year. And that's what Auerbach believed. You earn your way back in every year. He never let them get soft. And that's what dynasties are, is strong discipline from above.
At what point, though, do dynasties begin to take it for granted? When the Yankees assume that they're going to win the World Series every year, or be in the World Series every year, and they guarantee you a chunk of the World Series as part of your salary.
That used to be part of the salary. you're going to get World Series money, $4,000 or $5,000 in those days. But, the dynasties end when the players believe in the discipline handed down from above, or the self-pride. But dynasties also are ending because of drafts now, where the worst teams draft first, you know, and it did balance out pro football, and it did balance out pro basketball, and that's what finally ended the dynasties. John Wooden had one of the greatest dynasties of all time. He only had players for 3 years, and he had three different sets of players, and he won 10 national titles with them, big team, little teams, big teams.
But also it strikes me in terms of Major League Baseball, at least, the end of the reserve clause may have also meant the end of the dynasties, but who'd want to go back to the days of the reserve clause?
That's right. And it's funny how you look at ball clubs. Certain teams never make the playoffs, and yet they get the draft first, second, or third, like in the NBA. They never make intelligent draft. Auerbach drafted last 1 year, the last pick, and he took a fellow named John Havlicek, who became one of the greatest pros in the history of basketball. So there's always, like, certain organizations are better than other ones. They're smart up above. They work at their trade, and they study it, and they know how to run it. And some teams keep being mediocre, and you wonder why. But it's the same way in businesses. Certain outfits are just better than others. Better management. Management is the key. I was lucky. I was lucky that I got to be a part of all this and last as long as I did, and get to broadcast and get to be friends for life with many of these people. I hope that the modern reader, especially the younger people, read it and maybe get something out of it, just what it was like between 1945 and 1960 that paved the way for the sports revolution in America. The revolution was big-time television. Let's face it. My industry, TV sports, is what's fueled all these big salaries, all the... look at them now, they... Shaq O'Neal gets, what, $3 million a play a year, is going to make $10 or $15 million in endorsements. And it's a world sort of gone wild. And I don't resent them making that kind of money and everything. If they can do it, fine. But it's sort of craziness that didn't exist in this time.
Kurt Gowdy died in 2006. Last month would have been his 100th birthday. I'm Bill Thompson, and now I've heard everything.